in confidence cannot be, you can't subpoena someone, you can't force someone to testify. You're actually not even allowed to testify in court from something which you were told by your spouse, because if we were to open that box, it would lead to all sorts of problems. That we force people, we said things people wouldn't trust their own spouses because of what the potential ramifications would be. So with that in mind, I'd like to explore something, not for the litigator, not for the lawyer, not for the court judge, but for the halachic posek, for the rabbi. Can we accept archaeological finds in halachic decision-making? So I'll give you an extreme example of this. This example has not yet occurred. This was written by Rav Tzvi Aryeh Yehuda, one of the close Talmud of the Chazon Ish. We have letters from the Chazon Ish to this Talmud, Rav Tzvi Aryeh Yehuda, talking about how much he loves this Talmud. He quotes a really quite a remarkable conversation he claims to have had with the Chazon Ish. He says as follows, and I'm quoting, "Assuming that an old Sefer Torah from a very remote past will be found, let us say a Rashi, Rabbi Akiva, or any other great authority of antiquity, or for the sake of argument, even of Moshe Rabbeinu himself, and that we will detect textual variants, distinguishing it from the current Masoretic texts." Meaning, let's say we find a Torah, and there are different little minor nuances, differences between our Torah and the Torah of, let's say, Moshe Rabbeinu. The question he was asked was, what are we going to do? Will we change our secret Torah to fit his? Or will we say, no, that one must be puzzled because our text is the right one? So that's an extreme example. We have not yet found such a sacred Torah, but I'd like to give you just a few, just a little inkling, a little bit of a sample of actual halachic differences we could come to based on archaeology. So let me show you again just one example here. Have we solved the question of tchelas, right? So we have a mitzvah in the Torah to wear tzitzis, and along with those tzitzis, you're supposed to wear some number of strings of tchelas. And so here you have an area where we kind of lost the Masorah. For over 1,000 years, we do not know what Tchelas is. You can see on the side I'm wearing it, so that might give you a little bit of a thought about where I'm going over here. But the sources on Tchelas, about what exactly Tchelas is, and Tchelas has to be from a very specific source. It cannot be from the wrong species or the wrong source, or your Tchelas are not kosher. You do not get the mitzvah. So have we rediscovered the source? Right now, there is a guess. There is a group of people who are pushing for what's known as the Murex trunculus as being the tchelas, the sort of snail. And they are able to extract blue dye from the snail. They believe that that is the possibly at least the source for tchelas. You might be getting a mitzvah d'oraisa by wearing tzitzis with that dye on them. So have we found the proper tchelas? So if you look at just the halachic sources, I would say you could pretty easily argue either way. Their sources are ambiguous. You can focus on these ones, or you can focus on that one. It's domel ledag. So is a snail domel ledag? Is it like a fish? It's not a fish. People, if you just have the halachic source, you can say basically, whatever you want, depending on where you want to go with it. The big argument, which I think the best argument which they have, is from archaeology. So I'm just going to give you, again, they have more than this, but just the Gemara in Shabbos says that the chilazon is the source for the tzelas, says that the chilazon was found off the northern coast of Eretz Yisrael in the region of Tzur and Haifa. So Murex dye from this specific shell is well documented to have been caught and produced in that area. And scores of dyeing vats with mounds of Murex shells have been found in that region. Furthermore, we found wool dyed the color blue from the Murex trunculus specifically at that time. It's not on tzelas, it's not on tzitzit per se. We haven't found blue strings of tzitzis with the Murex trunculus, but we found wool. I don't know if it was wool, I forget what material, but dyed with the Murex trunculus, dyed blue. The final thing, and I just think this is absolutely fascinating. I have a picture here, which by Tzvi Benach had a very similar picture in his presentation, but this is a remarkable coin which we found. This actually is on the second page, the one which Rabbi Tzvi Benach had. But the first page, you don't have to look at that, we'll get there. But on the first page, so there's the historical record shows that the Romans got rid of, they banned the use of tchelas. They banned the use of tchelas, which is why the Jewish people no longer had, we weren't able to figure out what tchelas was. And I have this Gemara here in Sanhedrin, which is very, very difficult to understand unless you have a translation which puts in all of the bracketed messages over here. But they have a very like cryptic statement over here. Shalkulei l'Rava. They said to Rava the following statement: Zug ba me rekes rakos, that there was a group of two talmidei chachamim who came from Rakos, betafsu nesha, and they did something which caused the eagle to go and capture them. Now, it's not clear from the Gemara exactly who this eagle is. In their hand, they had something, they were smuggling something, and that's what caused them to be caught by the eagle, the quote-unquote eagle. They had talus in their hand. And the message continues that because of Hashem's mercy and because of their own zekuyos, they were able to go and leave and make it out in peace. So what's going on over here? So the eagle is actually, it's well documented that the eagle was looked at as the king of the birds. It was a sign of the imperial power, and it was a reference to Rome. So on the left over here, you have a coin, which is actually an eagle. It's a Roman coin from the 200s, and it has this big picture of an eagle, and they were banning people from smuggling out tales. And the item in between the eagle's legs, I was looking actually on bidding websites online. This is not up from a Jewish website over here. They all call this a murex conch. I don't know how you can tell the difference between a murex conch and a different type of conch, a different type of shell. But apparently the conch in between its legs, the little shell in between its legs, is the murex trunk, is the murex conch, the same snail, which they were banning people from smuggling out. So in terms of the archaeology, you have a very strong argument to make that this is treles. Again, I'm not making any you know statements about halacha over here, exactly what the psak is, but I'm just giving you areas of halacha where archaeology could lend a big hand in making a decision. I'll give you one more example before we get into the, you know, the actual meat and bones of the question. And please, if anyone has any questions or, you know, articles or disagreements, I'm happy to take them. But let me give you just one more example. We just had Pesach. And on Pesach, if you look at, I was using Rabbi Moses Haggadah. So if you use Rabbi Moses Haggadah and many others, when you have to have matzah, so how much matzah are you supposed to have? What's the shear? It's not a trick question yet.
Kazayas.
A kazayas. We're supposed to have a kazayas. So a kazayas translates to an olive. How big is an olive? So you think an olive is an olive, right? That's 3 to 7 cc. Cc is basically interchangeable with milliliters, if that's helpful for anyone. Okay, let's call it 5 milliliters. You look at Rabbi Moses Haggadah, how much you're supposed to have. You have 3/4 of a matzah on a page. So how do you get from 3 milliliters, which is like, I don't know, you could separate that into 15, one handmade, one machine matzah into 15, of these 5 cc kizaisim. And Rabbi Moses is telling you, you got to have 3/4 of a matzah. So there's chumras, which we can talk about, to maybe have 2 kizaisim. So, you know, maybe we'll call it a little less than 3/4. We'll call it 3/4 divided by 2 is going to be 3/8. But whatever it is, you know, we can talk about, maybe it's not exactly as big as Rabbi Moses is presenting it, but how did we get such big shearing of a kizai? So let me tell you just the story. I'm going to give it, going to be makatzer over here a little bit. But we know that in Ashkenaz, you look through their cookbooks, you look through their ingredient lists, you look through anything we have in, German and France, they don't seem to ever talk about olives. This is not halachic I'm talking. They don't seem to have olives in German and France. So the Tosafists are trying to figure out, I have this thing called a kazayis. I have to go and measure a kazayis of matzah. Same thing's true, by the way, for Marlar and for so many other things at the Seder. And they're trying to figure out how much is this. So they pick 2 Gemaras and Talmudic brilliance. They figure out, I think I figured out how big a kazayis is. And so how do they figure it out? So they have 2 sources over here, source 2 and 3. And they seem to have a contradiction, but the contradiction, the Tosafists view as actually a proof. Because they don't really know, they haven't seen a kazayis. By the way, the Sfardim, so Sfardi Poskim, guess what they say kazayis is? They never talk about it. Why don't they talk about how big a kazayis is?
Because they know.
Because they have zeisim in front of them. They have olives. You don't need to tell me how big an olive is. They have olives. So you look at the Tosafists, they're trying to figure out what is the size of the kazayis. The first source over here, source 2, says Rav Adar bar Achi Masni. He's got a braisa which says v'shiru chachamim the ein beis hablia matzim yoser mishnei zeisim, that the throat is unable to go and hold more than 2 zeisim. Throat, apparently, if you were to swallow once, you could only fit 2 zeisim down your throat in one time. That's source 1. Source 2. Over here with in Gemara Yoma, seems to have a very similar statement. Rabba Ba'u Didei Amar Mikol Ochel She'achel, etc. Just jumping to the underline, Ein Beis Habli Amachtik Yoser Mi Beitzas Tarnagolos, that the throat cannot hold any more than a Beitzas Tarnagolos, than the egg of a Tarnagolos. So I don't know what an egg is, but what an olive is. I have 2 statements. One says that an egg is, that my throat can fit an egg. One tells me that, the other one tells me that I can fit 2 olives down my throat. I figured it out. An olive is half the size of an egg. And that's what the Re says. The Rebbeinu Tam has a different opinion. There are more Gemaras and very much simplifying over here. But the Re comes to what, you know, is the simple conclusion from this Gemara. If you didn't know what an olive was, And he says a olive is half the size of an egg. If you look at our standardized measurements, the average egg is around 50 cc, 50 milliliters. You know, maybe take off the shell, call it 47 milliliters, something like that. So now you get the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch quotes that which has been written. Again, the Sephardim don't ever tell you how big an olive is. They don't tell you because they have an olive. But they're looking at the Ri and Rabbeinu Tam. The Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Taf Pei Vav, in source 4, Shir Kizai Yesh Omin Dahavi Kechati Beitza. All he says is that the size of a kizai is half of an egg. So again, half an egg, you go from 50, let's call it around 25, maybe a little less than 25. You can understand how we jumped from 5 cc, 5 ml to 25 very quickly, and why we have such big masses. So here's the question. Maybe Tosfos is actually right. How do we know that our olives are the same size as the olives in the times of the Chazal? So Rabbi Nachman Slifkin did a lot of work on this topic. He has a very nice article called The Evolution of the Egg. And what he points out is just a few things. So first of all, we have many, many olive pits. There are tons of olive pits, ancient olive pits, 2,000 years old, exactly from when we want them to be. And they're all exactly the same size as our olive. That's point one. He then says, well, maybe you'll tell me, okay, but maybe the flesh was much bigger than, they have the same olive pit size, but maybe the flesh was much bigger, like Tosfos thinks that an olive is much bigger. Maybe there's bigger flesh on the olive to pit ratio. He says, we also have more than, I think he says, 3 trees, which are over 2,000 years old, 2,000 to 3,000 year old olive trees. They're still producing fruit from that very same time that they were started. Every single year, they're producing more and more olives, and they're all exactly the same as our current olives. The flesh to pit ratio has not changed. So Rabbi Nachman Slifkin says, you know, you've got the shiurim we have on the Seder. He's not telling you, you know, the chumrah, it's wonderful to be machmir, but the archaeology would seem to tell us that the size of a kezias is the size of a kezias. So how do we deal with the archaeology versus that, you know, what the Shulchan Aruch tells us, that it's half the size of an egg? So can we paskin based on archaeology? That is the big question, which I want to tackle with you. And I want to just mention, I've given you just 2 examples, but we can, you know, I don't have enough fingers on my hand to talk about the current examples that we have. You know, they found ancient homes where the mezuzahs were all imprinted. So there's a machlokas, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, I believe, about whether the mezuzahs should lie flat or they should be standing up. All of the mezuzahs are either standing up or slightly to diagonal, kind of how we put up our mezuzahs, but clearly against Rabbeinu Tam. Other examples are for Purim. On Purim, you're supposed to lay on a different day in a walled city if it was walled since the times of Yehoshua ben Nun, and not if it wasn't walled from the times of Yehoshua ben Nun. Now we have archaeology, we can tell which cities were walled from the times of Yehoshua ben Nun. Should we paskin based on that archaeology? I could go Oat Matzah and Horstrap. There's many, many examples we could talk about. I just want to give you a sampling. And as we find more and more archaeology and Middle Eastern archaeology continues to evolve, certainly we're going to have more and more nafkaminas or potential nafkaminas of this question of should we be paskining based on archaeology. Okay, so what do our sources say? For those of us who have read Rav Schechter's Svarim, so I'm not asking you this question, but what would you think our earlier source on this topic would be? Give me a century. So I would have guessed, I don't know, 1500s, 1600s, like how long have they been digging up things to pass in halacha? So Rav Schechter in Nefesh HaRav shows that the first source is actually more than one, which he also points out. It's actually the Gemara. The Gemara talks about everything. We think that the Gemara, like, okay, they talk about all these cases which don't apply to every single thing which we need in some way or another. We delve out from the Gemara itself, which is why it's so important to learn so much Gemara. But the Gemara has this fascinating story in Source 5 over here. The Amar Rav Bar Bar Chai. I want everyone here to tell me about the conclusion. There was one time I was walking in the midbar. There was an Arab merchant who joined me to go and escort me. So fascinating story. Unclear in the Meforshim if we're supposed to take this literally, in this whole thing. What he says is, I'd like to show you the Mesei Midbar. I want to show you the dead in the midbar. And I apologize, I just remembered I did not record.
I am.
You're recording. Fantastic. Wow. Okay. So So I want to show you the dead of the midbar. I want to show you those who passed away in the midbar. We're talking about from the midbar before we enter into Eretz Yisrael. what is the, he wants to show him the Metei Midbar. So they find the Metei Midbar, they find the dead of the Midbar, and they're still wearing their tzitzit. And as background over here, there's a machlokas beis hillel beis shammai, exactly how many strings of tzitzit you're supposed to wear. And he says, aha, we're going to solve the machlokas. So what's he do? Chaski chada karna detelta dechad minayim. Cuts off one of the corners of tzitzit from one of the Metei Midbar, and he's going to go bring it back to the beis medrash, and he's going to tell everyone, okay, we've got the answer over here. But things didn't work out. Rashi explains that animals stopped moving. They were on, I don't know, donkeys, whatever it was, and the animals stopped moving. They would not move because he had in his hand, a relic of the Metei Midbar. Amarli, so the Arab merchant tells him, did you take something from the dead of the Midbar? Ahadri, please return it. The Gemiri, we have a tradition, demand the shakti midi minayu lo mistagi le. Anyone who takes something from the dead of the Midbar, they won't be able to be successful. They're not going to make it out. So that's why we're stuck. So as the Ahadar Tiyahad, so he said, fine. They put back the corner of the tzitzis. The Ahadar Mistagilan, and then they were able to travel. The animals started moving. So now he gets to base Medrash, and he says, guys, you're not going to believe it. I was about to answer this big machlokas, beis shammai, beis hillel we had, and then this crazy thing happened, and so I had to put it back. So just as background over here also, right, the person speaking is Rabba Bar Bartana. His real name wasn't Rabba. It was Rebbe Abba. For some reason, that's truncated to Rabba. So they said back to him, he was probably hoping for some praise about what a cool story. But instead, Amrili, what did they say? Kol Abba Chama. Anyone whose name is Abba is a donkey. Out of grace. The Kol Bar Bar Chana, Sifsa. Anyone whose name is Bar Bar Chana is a fool. Why did you do this? Meaning, why did you just leave the stuff over there? Or why were you going to take the strings? You want to know to be passing like Beis Hillel or Beis Shammai. Why didn't you count it? Why didn't you count how many strings are? You didn't know the answer because you just cut it off and you put it back, and we still don't know the answer. End of story. Okay, guys, what do you think? Is it archaeology, yes or no? What, I'm getting a lot of nods, right? This seems to be, Rav Schechter points this out in Devashar Rav, I believe, that this seems to be a fantastic source. The whole Beis Medrash and Rabbi Mar Bachana himself were planning on passing based on archaeology, and then they're upset to him. Why didn't you just count the things properly? Another line. Let's do another source up here. Source 6. So there's a machlokes exactly what the tzitz on the Kohen Gadol was supposed to look like. On the tzitz, it's written Kodesh LaHashem. This person is holy unto God. So how exactly do you arrange those letters? So Ve'atan, you have this price. Tzitz kamin taf shel dahab. So it was this, a gold plate. Okay, gives us a few more, a little bit more about the dimensions of that tzitz. The kasubamot the day shikin yud and then hey lamala, the kodesh lamid lamata. So the first sheet of the opinion of the Tanna Kama is that it was written in two separate lines. The first line kind of said kodesh la, and then above it was la Hashem, Hashem's name on top. You want Hashem's name to be above the kodesh la, and so you have it in two lines. That's the Tanna Kama. And then Rebbe Lezer, Rebbe Yossi, there's a whole background over here to what exactly Rebbe Lezer, Rebbe Yossi is going to say. He once did a toga for the Roman government, for people in the Roman government, and so they allowed him access to, I guess, the Vatican or something like that, to go and see many of the things which we lost. And so he took a stroll. And so we have a few statements of his, of things which he saw in the amongst the Roman treasures. So the other Rebbe Lezer, Rebbe Yossi, I really see the ear Roman. I went to the city of Rome. I saw the tzitz. The Kasuv Kodesh Lashem Beshita Achas. And I saw it was all written on one line. It's not on two lines, it's on one line. So Rebbe Lezer, Rebbe Yossi disagrees based on, I think, what we can call archaeology. He is, redefining the past based on his current findings. So again, I think that's another great source. This source is what I was referring to, that the following one was from Rabbi Tzvi Benoff's presentation. But there's a, let's jump a millennium. To the Ramban. Ramban is Machlokas, Rashi, and the Riv. How big is the shekel? And their Machlokas is, let's say, in about a sixth. They're arguing on like about 17% about the weight of the shekel. And that's very important for various halachos, including, let's say, Pidyon HaBen. How much are you supposed to weigh for Pidyon HaBen? Nowadays, it seems to have accepted with Chaim Noah, who says that it's 96 grams of silver, which you need for Pidyon HaBen. Shechter likes to say the minhag is to use 100 grams of silver. If you look at this machlokas, so they're arguing on about a 17% to 1/6 difference. Rashi is of the opinion that it is lighter, and the Rif believes that it is heavy. So the Ramban in his commentary Al HaTorah very strongly takes the Rif side. He thinks that the Rif is correct, that that it's the heavier, that it's the Rif's version and not like Rashi. And then we have this letter from the Ramban, which was added to his Perush in some versions. It's quoted by later Rishonim. He sends a letter back because the Ramban made Aliyah. And the Ramban reports the following story after he makes Aliyah. So he says, oh, we'll read, it's beautiful. Berechani Hashem Adko, God has given me such blessing. Shedachiti uvachti la'ako, because I've come to Ako now, matati sham v'yad p'tnei ha'aretz in Torah 7. Matbea keset, l'utak, the faithful son. There's this coin which has been imprinted on it. On one side, there is this kind of this sort of staff which is flowering, and on the other side, there's this kind of chalice. And there's writing on both sides. So if you look, we actually have these coins, which is very cool. We know, look, these are two sides of the same coin. We actually know that they're from the Bar Kokhba revolt. And we'll see what they're in. But the Ramban can't read it, because in the times of the Bar Kokhba revolt, they're still using Ksav Ivri, a different form of the Hebrew letters that we have, that we use nowadays. And it says as follows, so what do? We got these coins. We got to show someone who reads Hebrew. So we showed it to the Samaritans. Samaritans were this quasi-Jewish group, which in the times of Mishnayos, they're still debating whether they are Jewish, whether they aren't Jewish. Not exactly, you know, the most reliable of our Jewish brethren, but they showed the Ksav to the Kusim, the Kargul Miyad. The moment they saw it, they were able to read it. Ksav Ivri, Asher Nishal the Kusim. It's because it's in Ksav Ivri, which the Kusim still read. There should be a Sanat there. The Kargul Miyad Sanat Achad Shekel HaShekalim. On one side, it says, this is the Shekel HaShekalim. This is the Shekel. Minatzad Asheni, Yerushalayim HaKdosha. Okay, very beautiful. Okay, they give him a whole drasha. They're telling him what the pictures mean. One is Aaron's staff, which is flowering, and the other one is the Kinten of Haman. It has the you know, the man which was stored over from the Midbar. And we waited, and lo and behold, it's a certain weight. The exact weight which Rashi said the weight of a shekel was. And I saw the exact same type of coin, a chati shekel. Meaning I saw a similar coin, which said chati shekel. Says the Ramban, we have a huge support for Rashi, that Rashi is actually correct. So in this letter, the Ramban is closer, but he's kind of retracts from his previous opinion supporting the Rif. Based on this archaeological evidence, based on the shekel he found, based on what the Samaritans told him, about this shekel. All good so far. I just have one more source, and then I'm going to show you that everything I've been saying might be incorrect. Yeah.
In the past few cases, are we discussing reliability, or are we assuming it's reliable, and it's just a matter of whether we count it?
Good. I mean, it seems both. I mean, it seems these people who are quoting them clearly assume A, that it's reliable, and B, that we can use it. Right. So both points, they're saying this is a proof. You know. So at the moment you're saying this is a proof, you're saying I think it's true, and you're saying, I think we can bring this into the halach discussion. So, last source over here, and we could bring, you know, a couple others, but this is the last source I'm going to show you. This one is something which is brought down by the Mordechai and others. The Mordechai, we know, was killed in the Rindfleisch massacres in the 1200s, I believe. But he says as follows. He's been talking about Machloket Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, about how to arrange the tefillin. So I gave you a picture over here just to help us out over here. The question is about the order of the parshas. Right? There's four parshas. Tefillin, there's Shema, there's Dayan Shema, there's Kaddish and Dayakim Yafa. The question is those last two. If we were to look at, if we're looking at the tefillin, so you look at the picture first. Rabbeinu Tam goes from looking at the tefillin from right to left, Kaddish, Dayakim Yafa, and then he reverses Dayan Shema and Shema. Whereas Rashi is Shema first and then Dayan Shema. According to both opinions, the other shitas is presumably, possible. The way that people refer to Rabbeinu Tam is Habayot Fahamsim. Two Gehayah, they're in the middle. The question is, which way are we supposed to pass it? So this was a debate for many, many centuries, and even nowadays, you know, although we pass it like Rashi, still anywhere, still into Rabbeinu Tam. So the Mordechai quotes the following story. Shalchu Ketav Me'eretz Yisrael. We have a letter from Eretz Yisrael. Shenach Labima Shal Kevri Yechezkel. I don't know exactly what this means. Something fell on the kever of Yechezkel Hanavi. That the kever of Yechezkel's Hanavi was opened up, and they said, well, once his kever is opened up, let's take a look inside. He was buried with tefillin, presumably, Matsusham tefillin, Yeshanim, and Ode, Sfira Rashi. And what did they find? They looked into tefillin, they opened them up, and they found tefillin, kisei de Rashi. Exactly like Rashi. Tefillin says the Mordechai said the smug, this is a fantastic proof that Rashi's right, and Rabbeinu Tam was incorrect. We found all more proof. Yechezkel HaNavi was wearing Rashi's tefillin, not Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. Beautiful. Okay, those are the four sources we're looking at. We have two Tanaitic sources. You know, we've got that, I guess, one Tana, one Amora. We've got the Gemara Baba Basra, right, with Rabbi Avrechana. We have this Mishnah with Rabbi Elazar ben Biyosi based on the what was written in Rome on the Tzitz. We have this book from the Ramban, and then we also have this Mordechai by the Machlokas, Rashi, and Rabbeinu Tam. Okay, so I've been giving you one story. What I'd like to show you now is that every single one of the proofs I just brought you, people say was totally incorrect, and I'm misreading them. Now, how am I going to do that? So we didn't totally misread them, but the question is, are these accepted? So let's work backwards for a moment. This Mordechai, which I just quoted, so the Drisha responds. The Drisha is not impressed. The Drisha says, very nice that you found tefillin in Yechezkel's kever, and they're written like Rashi. But can I ask you, what do we bury in general? What you know what Jameis goes? When we have puzzle stuff, we bury it. Says the Drisha, why was it buried? It's because it was puzzle. That was the wrong tefillin. Rabbeinu Tam was right. That's what the Drisha says. He's not impressed. Right? So we can talk about, maybe we could use it as evidence, but the Drisha says it's not reliable. You can't know because something was buried that that's the correct way. Maybe that's the wrong tefillin specifically. You go up again, we dismiss the Haramban about the weight of the shekel. Right? So Ramban ended up saying the correct value is Rashi's value, the lighter value, and not that of the Rift and others. You look in Shulchan Aruch in the Siman about Pidyon HaBen and Siman Shin Hei. How does he paskin? He paskins against Rashi. He paskins against Rashi and Ramban. The Be'er Hagola points out the numbers which he give are in line with the opinion of the Rift, not in line with the opinion of Rashi. So that means that the Ramban's shekel, which he found, was not good enough evidence to convince the Shulchan Aruch that we should be paskining like archaeological evidence. So why not? So either it was some sort of fundamental objection. Can anyone raise what might be wrong with relying on the shekel that the Ramban found? Any thoughts? Yeah, go for it.
It would have been disintegrated over time.
Good, beautiful. So the Tach Beit says, a sixth, that's not so much. A sixth over 1,000 years, that's probably exactly how much it degraded over time. So you weighed it, it was a little lighter. Yeah, but it was probably a sixth bigger at the time when you got the shekel. So he's not impressed. There's another argument which people make. I'm not sure this one's less intuitive to me. Another reason you might not like this specific proof that Ramban gave.
Someone might have been shaving down their shekels.
Okay, someone might be shaving down their shekels. Similar idea. I mean, maybe it's a little smaller than actually. He says, you trust the Samaritans, those Kusim? They're not reliable. They're the bad Jews. They're the people who are messing us up all the time. Yeah, they told you the shekel shekel. Maybe it said, you know, I don't know, Chinese coin from who knows what. So the Abar Benel says, I'm not sure that we can trust this proof from the Kusim. So you have, you know, this reliance on archaeology. You have this pushback. Well, how do you know that you're really interpreting the data correctly? And that's a theme which you continue to see. We'll go back, we'll see one more example, that the Tzitz, right? So what, you have this Machlokas, the Tana Kama, and the Levi Rebbe Yossi. Was it on two lines of the Tana Kama says it? Or was it on one line, like Rebbe Levi Rebbe Yossi said he saw it? So what would you expect the Rambam to paskin? I'm the Rambam, I'm paskining Halacha. We have archaeological evidence, it's on one line. So let's see, what's the Rambam say? You look in source 9 over here. He says, Ketzad ma'ate ha-tzitz. How do you make the tzitz? So Osef tas shel dahav rochev shnei efos. Whatever he gives you the dimensions, the makim, the ozim, the kotzev alav shnei sheet. You write it on two separate lines. Not one line like Rebbe Elazar ben Biyosi saw. You write it on two lines. Kodesh la-Hashem, Kodesh la-Mata, la-Hashem, mil mouth. Against what we expect him to say. Be'im kosu b'shita achas, kosher. But if you were to write it on the line, it would be kosher b'diyat. It's not the ideal way, but it is allowable. Once in a while, they would write it on one line. What's he saying? He's saying, okay, very nice. The Kesef Mishnah points this out. Where did he get this from? Kesef Mishnah points out, he had to deal with the archaeological evidence somehow. So we said, yeah, very nice, Rebbe Elazar, because we found one tzitz which happened to have it on one line. Once in a while, you had a bit the Evid tzitz, which had it on one line. But the ideal way to make the tzitz is still, like the Tana Kama says, still is to go and use two lines. I heard a joke from my father-in-law, which I still don't understand, so I'm going to edit it. But I thought it was, the punchline was funny, so we're going to see if we can edit. But he says that there were different countries which were arguing. They're trying to revisit the past. I don't know, there's some apocalyptic moment Everyone's forgotten their past. They're trying to figure out who had the most illustrious past. So one digs up a copper wire and they say, oh, they must have had cable internet. And this is 500 feet below the ground. And another country goes 1,000 feet below the ground and they find a fiber optic cable. And they say, I don't know. I don't even know what fiber optics make, but they had must have had fiber optic internet. And then the third country, you know, not wanting to be outdone, digs 10,000 meters into the ground, finds absolutely nothing. And they say, ah, they must have had wireless internet. So they misinterpret evidence. You know, there's many different ways to misunderstand exactly what's going on. What you see from these three sources is not so simple to make a claim, oh, look, at the archaeology, therefore the conclusion is X. Is there a way to say fundamentally, I don't like archaeology, I won't accept archaeology? So I'll tell you, there are poskim who make this argument. We go back to that first source, the Gemara Bava Basra. So again, Rav Bar Chana was trying to cut off a corner, it didn't work out, he put it back, and then the whole base manager got upset at him, you know, why are you doing it? So the simple explanation, without a doubt, is like Moira Rabbi Rav Shachter said, that you see you can use archaeological evidence. Rav Chaim Kanievsky writes in Taimon Tikra, now what do you see? You think Rav Bar Chana was a fool? Now, Rav Bar Chana was one of our most amazing Amorim. You think he couldn't have thought to count it? Kadosh Baruch Hu clearly didn't want him to count. Kadosh Baruch Hu stopped him from counting the archaeology. It's true that they thought they could use archaeology, but in fact, the Kadosh Baruch Hu made sure that they did not archaeology. It doesn't say what the problem is. Maybe it's unreliable, or maybe there's a more fundamental objection. I'm seeing a lot of confused faces. I agree that's not how I would have, you know, went with that Gemara, but that's what Chaim Kanievsky does. He doesn't say what the problem is, but maybe we can raise the issue of that Pandora's box, that kind of, you know, spousal privilege in law. It could be there's a fundamental issue. If you think about how many areas of halacha which are possible to uproot, you could rewrite so many different areas of the Shulchan Aruch. Yes, we got rid of, in theory, you know, half of a kabetza is the size of an olive, but there's so many other sifrim in Shulchan Aruch that says X and you're going to pass me Y. Maybe it's just fundamentally we are uncomfortable to rely on archaeology because Pandora's box, if that could open. Now, I personally, you know, struggle with that. It's a Torah's MS. We're trying to figure out the truth of what, you know, halacha and Torah is. But I'm not going to say that that's not an approach which someone could take. So maybe let's questions also just before we get to just some of the conclusions of poskim over here. Okay. So should we reconfigure all of our measurements? Oh, did I miss a question, please? Yeah.
I mean, with the Nefer and God, you said maybe like going down to six, can you check about the dating for that now, just to see if we lose weight of the six?
It's a good question. I think more than that, we now have many of this type of shekel, you know, which does seem to align with, they're all is apparently pretty standardized as being the Shita of Rashi and the Ramban. So the opinion of, you know, the Tashbates' objection that maybe it's gotten smaller probably is, you know, not true because of how consistently they've degraded or not degraded. So I don't know. I hear in the times of those who are passing halacha that you can see in the Shulchan Aruch, you could have seen that that was a fair objection. But maybe that's the reason we're generally more machmir the Shita of Rashi. So maybe, like you're saying, maybe that was defending the truth, but maybe things, excuse me, be the other way around. I hear what you're saying. I'll leave it at that. Okay. So what do poskim say at the end of the day? Should we reconfigure all of our measurements to align with archaeology? Can we say with certainty that the Murex trunculus is the Tcheles? If we found a Sefer Torah, which was from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, would we fix all of our Sefer Torah to go and fit that Sefer Torah? So the answer is it's nuanced and it's complicated. And as we saw, most proofs you bring from archaeology can be deflected. So the Usher Weiss takes this one of... senior postgame in Israel. I think now he's involved in the OU, my understanding is. I don't know exactly what his formal role is, but I'm sure many of us in the room have heard of him. But Rav Asher Weiss says, he basically sides with Rav Chaim Kanievsky, very interestingly. He says, we cannot accept archaeology for halach. He's talking specifically in the context of Tcheles over here, and he writes very poetically, but he says, we cannot use archaeology. It is too unreliable. That's basically his argument. He says, it's fundamentally archaeological, unreliable, so therefore don't rely on it. So it says as follows. This is in source number 10. I know, I recognize that archaeology is something which is accepted in different areas of scientific study. Because over there, they don't need things to be so accurate. Okay, you know, as long as we have a basic idea, that'll fit good enough for our Wikipedia. They work off of conjecture. You find an old item. You try and figure out logically, okay, what was probably going on with over here? What exactly were they doing with this thing? And then whatever, he goes on, he says, whatever was most accepted on the heart, whatever seemed like the most likely possibility, that's what they write in their encyclopedias. That's how they define the historical record. He says at the beginning of the next paragraph, "Ach lo kach machshava ha-halacha." That is not how halacha works. "Ein zu darko below zu shvata." This is not its way. This is not the way that it speaks. The hashara ain't a right. These are not my bolds. These are his bolds. He says that hashara, that conjecture, is not the proof of the ikar. We can't bring it into the halachic calculus. It is like hearsay in a court of law. Benegit kol hashara le'olam. And he goes on. He says, for every single conjecture you could make up, we could come up with four different possibilities with a different understanding. You thought that was Yechezkel HaNavi's filling? No, it was the puzzle filling, which we had to bury. So you can come up with so much. He says, even if you can't come up with anything, he says in the very last line, if you can't come up with any other possibility, well, maybe you're just not thinking of the right possibility. There's always another possibility when looking at archaeology. He throws it, blasted out of the water a little bit, and says we cannot use archaeology at all. Yeah, I see a question over here.
Yeah, we can say these statements are like many different kinds of proofs in Judaism, like understanding in the Gemara. Sometimes you can deny, like,
right, Ramban in his Hakdama writes, there's almost nothing which is like an ironclad proof. Everything you can say this way or that way a little bit. And the question is, okay, but what's the most misstabber? So I struggle with this, but I'm not going to avoid quoting it, that's for sure. Yeah.
Sounds like from what he's saying, but then that pretty much arises not fundamentally opposed in principle to archaeology, it's just that it doesn't have a lot of perspective.
Right. So it's confusing. I don't know exactly how to. It seems like he has a fundamental objection, because what he says in his tshuva is that it's not even enough to create a suffix. He first starts his tshuva. He says, I don't think suffix deoraisa lechomra applies to tchelas for whatever reason. And then he says, even if it did apply, I don't even think it counts as a suffix because archaeology is garnished, basically. So it seems like a fundamental objection, even though he's saying it based on the issue of lack of reliability. Otherwise, you should at least have a suffix. So it's a little unclear to me exactly. Would there be archaeological evidence, which is like, okay, you can't disagree with this. I don't know, you got a big sign which says, here lies Yechezkel's tefillin. These are kosher from written in stone. So would he still say the same thing? I don't know. But in this tshuva, at least, he seems to take a fundamental objection. Yeah.
So in a lot of the sources, there was a Machlokes, and then the archaeological evidence sided with the side of the Machlokes. Is there a Chilek between like no foundation and times when there's a Machlokes and the evidence sides the part?
Beautiful, beautiful. That's fantastic. I took off the next source, but I wanna touch on that exact point. I'll touch on that point in one moment, right? So on the opposite end, you have what Mori Berabi Rav Shechter says, which is all the sources seem to indicate we can use archaeology. At the same time, you have to be careful about how you interpret the evidence. There are different ways to interpret the evidence. So Shechter and many Shirim, I've heard him say, says Tchelas isn't necessarily a badai. We're not certain this is Tchelas, but it's at least a suffix. Archaeology is enough of a question. It's not the greatest question of this Tchelas. And suffix deoraisa lechumra should certainly say that you should therefore wear tefillin. So we have to be careful about how we interpret it, and that's really the message from many of these sources. But the simple explanation of the sources we have is that you certainly can look at archaeology. You have this middle view, which is what you're touching on, which is only quoted. I haven't seen anyone say this in writing themselves, but I found it quoted in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Moshe, and Rav Eliyahu. These are big hitter names. What all of them say is that there's a distinction to be made between things which we don't have a masora for, or our machlokas, and things which are uprooting a masora. So when it comes to changing the halacha of oat matzah, which we always assume oats are one of the five grains, and now you're going to tell me not that way, so that we won't listen to. We're going to say that certain things, change the size of a kazais, that we won't listen to against Shulchan Aruch. When you're dealing with maybe tcheles, where we don't have a masora, maybe they'd be more willing to, or where you're trying to go and answer machlokas. That's what, again, Rav Moshe, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and Rav Eliyahu are all quoted by different people as having said. It's them trying to put a lid on the Pandora's box. Right? We have this potential for uprooting so much halacha, And so, not halacha, but uprooting what's written in our halacha, you know, svarim. So they're trying to just say, let's put a lid on it. If it goes against the Torah, we're not willing to accept it in our court of law, so to speak. So I'll just conclude and we'll open it up. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to take them. So let's just sum up by saying, like everything in Yiddishkeit, there are a range of opinions on this question. My personal leaning is certainly to that of my Rebbe, that we should, you know, the sources strongly imply that we can take archaeology into our halachic decision-making. At the same time, we have to recognize the pitfall of the limitations. We can't just say, well, we found something, but must be that the case. And when one day we do find that pristine Sefer Torah, you know, from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, so we should certainly think twice before we make any corrections. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Does it matter who the archaeologists are? I mean, some archaeologists come with a bias, and, you know, I don't know if we can rely on, you know, there's a difference between something being really objective, saying, I don't know what this is, I found something, or I'm showing you. Or, I know what this is, or I think I know what this is, and I'm telling you what this is, and maybe this person has a bias.
Yeah, I would guess, I'm not, you know, I haven't seen enough written on this topic yet to quote someone who says this. My guess is that what we'd say is, look at what did they find. You tell me what you found, you know, and assuming that they're backed up with other scholars, you can tell me about, and we can make our own assessment of what you think that, what we think that means. You find some articles online when I was researching this topic, someone finds like one small thing in some place and they start making a whole story out of it. It's like really incredible, you know, people's creative minds with archaeology. So just show me the evidence. What did you find? And then I think, you know, we'll take it from there. It is a perspective which I would imagine we'd want to take. Yeah.
The theory of question of Moshe Rabbeinu Sefer Torah that you find, isn't that like somewhat addressed, like in that there's pre-received in the Gemara, which we don't have in the Sefer Torah? I think I'm here to read out a list of all
things. Yeah, so Rabbi Akiva Eger brings down quite a long list in Masechta Shabbos of differences between our text and texts of different Rishonim and Gemaras. So it's not like it's unheard of to go and say that there's a difference between our current text and what the text was of old. The question is the text, the fact that someone else is quoting a text doesn't mean that their text was right. It could be our text is right. And he's just noting differences. So he's not taking a stand on in a case where we knew that we had the correct text from way back when. Right? You need a sign that says this is the correct text for Moshe Rabbeinu in order for us to change it.
The Gemara learns Rashi from a period that we don't have. What does that mean?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. That's I'll leave that for the bigger hitters. Yes.
I seem to recall somebody told me once, you showed me that kind that the base of metrics they found like three separate Torah and two were one way and one was another way, and they were machria based on that.
Yes.
So it seems that there are ways of doing, you know, determinations
right.
Based on that kind of thing.
So
in fact, I think that Breuer's solid, but he is Tanakh. He wrote how he said he found a similar thing and said and independently said it matched with the few dot layers were the ones that they might have been trying to solve either.
It matched with the same one of the
Tehmanim. It matched the place where he could not resolve it with the case where the Tehmanim could not resolve it either. It was very interesting the way he described it.
No, so
it's in his Hagdama there for that.
Yeah. So part of the question is, will you paskin differently based on old text versus current text? When there they have three texts in front of them, it didn't necessarily go against the Masorah. They were trying to figure out the Masorah in that moment. So is that different from when we have a Masoretic text and now you're looking back at other texts from way back when? Rabbi, by quote at the beginning, Rabbi Tzvi Aryeh quotes that Gemara is proof that we just look at the majority of texts in front of us right now and we're never going to change anything based on one old text because it will still be, you know, it'll be one versus our 1,000 Sefer Torah, which we have right now. And that's debated, in other articles and tradition also. But yeah, that's certainly very interesting. The Rambam actually says I'm using just the Aleph Codex. He says, what are you using? He says, I'm using this. This is the right one. So that's very interesting. He's not working on majority. He works on what he thinks is the most definitive text. So it's a big question. Okay, I'm going to end over here because I think people have places to go. I really appreciate everyone being here, and I'm happy to continue the conversation. Thank you very much.
It's not a halakha.